This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we'll bring you some crucial updates. We'll also speak to Mike German, an attorney at the ACLU, who will talk to us about the FBI's efforts continuing to expand domestic surveillance powers. Sadly, it's not getting better. We're not restricting the FBI more. We're restricting it less and less and less. Some of us might have expected better from Obama. If we did, we were dead wrong.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Last week, President Obama visited Puerto Rico. He was the first U.S. president to visit Puerto Rico in almost 50 years, since John Kennedy went there in the early 60s. And it got a lot of coverage, was considered a big deal, was considered, of course, more to be about domestic politics and the number of Puerto Ricans and Latinos who vote here than about what's actually going on in Puerto Rico. But what was noticeable to me was the utter lack of coverage about the colonial status of Puerto Rico, the fact that it's a colony of the United States, that it's not independent. And that was really overlooked in, I would say, almost all the news coverage on his trip. And I was very sensitive to it because for many years, I've been an activist on Puerto Rican independence. And none of the history of Puerto Rico came out in the coverage. I just want to bring our listeners up to date on it a bit. Puerto Rico was taken by the United States in the war with Spain in 1897 and 1898. It was given to the United States by a treaty that it signed with Spain. It had been a colony of Spain. And then it became a colony of the United States, and it remains a colony today. And what's interesting about its colonial status is when we think about the removal, really, of Palestinians from Israel in 1948, or from the Mandate Territory in 1948, the 700,000, you have to look at Puerto Rico in the same way. The number of Puerto Ricans who've actually left Puerto Rico is well over a million, probably closer to 2 million. Huge mass exodus through the 50s and 60s, another exodus going on today. And you could argue, okay, Michael, it's not forced migration. It's not like they were pushed off their land by the United States, or as the Palestinians were pushed off their land by the Israelis. But in fact, it is a type of forced migration. What happened in Puerto Rico is the U.S. came in and they utterly exploited every single one of its resources. They exploited its sugar, exploited its tobacco, planted all that everywhere so that people could no longer survive on their own agriculture. Then it gave special deals to pharmaceutical companies that didn't have to pay taxes, then special deals to petrochemical companies, and essentially wiped out any possibility for the country of Puerto Rico to become self-sustaining. At that point, people became poorer and poorer, and were really, they're U.S. citizens, and were forced, essentially, in my view, to come to the United States to earn a living. So in some way, you can say the occupation of Puerto Rico has been completely illegal, really, since 1898, and certainly continuing today. One thing Obama said in his speech when he went to Puerto Rico was that he would obey a clear decision of the Puerto Rican people on what their status should be. Right now, it's a commonwealth, which is means it has some control over its internal affairs. The U.S. controls all its external affairs, its finances, it has, you know, its currency, its banks, its telecommunications, et cetera, et cetera. And coming up soon, supposedly, again, as I've seen this many times, is going to be a vote on the status of Puerto Rico, commonwealth, statehood, or independence. There's always been a big statehood push, even within Puerto Rico, saying we should become a state. And there's been some long, consistent, militant push for independence. And there's many who say, well, commonwealth is okay. Well, commonwealth is clearly a very odd situation because it doesn't have much authority over its external affairs, as well as the impoverishment of the population has been extraordinary. And the transfer payments to Puerto Rico from the United States for everything from veterans benefits to Social Security amount to 20% of all the income in Puerto Rico. So now they're suggesting another vote, and they've had votes in the past. The chances of an independence vote winning I don't know this, but my guess would be are not high. Because what people are afraid of in Puerto Rico is if they become independent, then all those transfer payments from the United States get cut off. That means 20% of the income, and the country becomes even more impoverished than now. So they're in this bind on a vote. And really, they shouldn't really be talking about a vote. The Decolonization Committee of the United Nations, which I once testified in about Puerto Rican independence, should really finally mandate that Puerto Rico should become independent. The only way to do a fair vote would be to have the U.S. hands off the place for a number of years, let them try and get on their feet on their own, and then have a vote. But I don't know what Puerto Rican independence advocates are calling for. My view is it should just be granted independence. So it's a colony, this BS by Obama that there'll be a clear decision. There can never be a clear decision in Puerto Rico by the electorate while the U.S. hand is in everything about Puerto Rico. In addition to having the bloody hands of the U.S. empire all over Puerto Rico, it's also affected, of course, internal politics in Puerto Rico. Just as internal politics in the U.S. have moved to the right, privatizing everything, that's going on in Puerto Rico. One of the differences in Puerto Rico, whether it's in the university or the labor system or the labor unions, is that there's a pitched struggle going on in Puerto Rico, indicating that the Puerto Rican people are not willing to take the privatization sitting down and that there will be a struggle. And I think that's related to the struggle against U.S. colonialism. People may feel, look, it's too hard for us to get out from under the United States, but we're not going to let our entire lives be privatized. The other thing I should say, it's not just the economic domination. It's also the FBI and intelligence domination. For years, the FBI has been all over the island, killing activists. We've interviewed some of those friends of those activists on this radio show. They've been jailing Puerto Rican independentistas. They've set up huge infiltration organizations, the FBI, to destroy the independence movement. So to the extent the independence movement ever had a foothold in Puerto Rico, which it of course still does, but ever was growing, the FBI and U.S. intelligence agents destroyed it. I've seen this over the years in my own work. As I said, I testified in front of the Decolonization Committee of the UN. For years, we represented Vieques demonstrators who were trying to close the U.S. military base on Vieques Island. That was finally closed. We represented many people who were victims of FBI surveillance. And in the 70s, I represented a number of Puerto Ricans who refused to be drafted into the Vietnam War. It's interesting why they refused. They refused in part, some of them, because they said, look, we pay taxes in Puerto Rico, we're U.S. citizens, but we can't vote in the presidential election. So how can you draft us when we don't have the right to help determine what wars this country should be in? Others took a more interesting and political approach. Again, I represented people taking what I would call the prisoner of war approach, what we did call the prisoner of war approach. They said, we're independentistas, we're fighting against colonial domination, and we are basically being taken as prisoners of war by the United States, and therefore we don't have to go to the draft. While none of those were successful, a lot of our clients actually were able to avoid the draft as we litigated on and on and on. The Puerto Rican independence movement, certainly as it was reflected in the United States, was at its height in the 70s when many parties were very active. So the coverage, really, of the Obama visit, there's only one way to say it. It was atrocious because we're talking about a colonial struggle here and not a question of Obama, the big head of the empire, stepping foot on one of his colonies. That's the way it should have been covered. On Law and Disorder, we've often brought you up-to-date news on Guantanamo, the so-called war on terror, military commissions, all that goes with Guantanamo, torture, indefinite detention, what I would like to call the Guantanamo syndrome or the American Operation Condor. If you remember, Operation Condor was when Chilean dictator Pinochet went around the world picking up people, torturing them, murdering them, and jailing them. We have our own. Let's call it the Guantanamo syndrome. Right now, as we speak, there's a new National Defense Authorization Act going through our wonderful Congress. It's passed the House. It's now in the Senate. This is the yearly bill that basically funds the empire's wars all over the world. And it's like a Christmas tree, and people put in some of the worst provisions you can imagine, and they're continuing to put in more and more ways of expanding the Guantanamo syndrome. And the main one is one that we've talked about before in a different context or a different statute, but it's now about to be amended. People may not recall, but the statute that began the war in Afghanistan was called the Authorization to Use Military Force, the AUMF. It's a very broad statute. It allowed the president on his own to attack any nation, state, person, individual, whatever, anywhere in the world who was in any way involved with 9/11, peripherally in any way at all. But it was linked to 9/11. And it's a terrible statute because that's what the president, whether it was Bush or Obama, is now using to go after not just Afghanistan, but to go after Pakistan, to go after Yemen. The AUMF is an awful statute as currently written because the president is using that not just for the war in Afghanistan, which it was originally written for, but the war in Pakistan, the war in Yemen, probably war in North Africa, the tension of people he can pick up anywhere in the world, etc. So it's an awful statute. As broad as it is, and as bad as it is, and as much authority as it gives the president to make war anywhere in the world without going back to Congress, without going to the American people, it's about to get worse. The House of Representatives just made it worse. And the question is whether the Senate will continue with leaving it in the statute as it is. As I said, the old AUMF allowed attacks on any nation, state, etc., involved in 9/11 anywhere in the world. This one takes out any link with 9/11. It essentially says that anyone that's a threat to the United States involved in an act of terrorism, whether in the U.S. or abroad, can be subject to attack by the president, military attack and detention. So it takes out any link with 9/11, essentially broadening the so-called war on terror even more than President Bush had done. Now, it's interesting. The Obama administration says this is unnecessary, and I wouldn't say they're dead against it, but they'd rather not have it in there. And it's not that they're being so wonderful about this. It's just that they're already going way beyond the current AUMF and attacking anybody in the world. So they're essentially saying, don't put it in writing and make a red flag out of it. Let's keep it away. So they're expanding war power. So if you look at the American empire as one that is now sustained by war, some 771 military bases, plus a power in one person, the president, to attack anywhere in the world, you're talking about an empire that's built on tanks, aircraft carriers, and the Pentagon, and war. And it's not going to be good going forward. If there's any characteristic of this empire that seems out there and up front right now, it's that this is an empire of war. The National Defense Authorization Act also has some special provisions about Guantanamo. I won't go through all the details, but basically we've already said on this show, Guantanamo is becoming a permanent aspect of the detention system in this world or in this country. It's open now forever, it seems. There's laws that say you can't bring people to the United States for trial. There's preventive detention and military commissions. Well, this National Defense Authorization Act, hard to believe, but makes those provisions even worse. It now says that any non-citizen held by the U.S. military, any non-U.S. citizen held by the U.S. military in a foreign country cannot be brought to the United States. Not just people in Guantanamo can't be brought here, but people in any foreign country. So if someone's picked up, as they have been in the past, for bombing like the USS Cole or something, they can no longer be brought to the United States for trial, even though the Cole people were brought to the U.S. for trial, or at least some of them. That means they have to be tried in the so-called military commissions or rump trials, trials that are completely no good for anything. A pretty amazing bill, basically saying no more constitutional courts. Let's just try these people in some court we set up somewhere in the world. Very, very bad provision. It also says that any non-citizen in the United States who's involved in a terrorist attack cannot be tried in a regular U.S. federal court, but must be tried in a military commission. So there you go. If you thought we were moving toward fascism in this country, at least certain aspects of it, there we see it, open and notorious. Perhaps we'll be lucky, and these three provisions that I've talked about, the broadening of the war, prohibition on bringing anybody from any foreign country to the United States for trial, and the prohibition on trying any alleged U.S. terrorist non-citizen in the United States in a regular court, we're hopeful that those three provisions won't pass. But they've passed the House already, and it's not clear to me they won't go through the Senate. It's not getting better. It's getting worse and worse and worse. Over the years, we have brought you information about terrorist acts against Cuba and the Cuban people. We have focused particularly on a man named Luis Posada, who is currently living in the United States, formerly worked with the CIA, and accused of a variety of terrorist acts, including the bombing of a Cuban airliner in 1976, in which 73 Cubans were killed. The entire Cuban young fencing team was actually on that flight. Despite his long record of terrorist acts, he is in the United States, and the United States did put him on trial for a perjury case a few months ago. We brought you that news, and he was acquitted of the perjury, although it seems very bizarre to us that he was. The evidence was overwhelming, but he was acquitted by a U.S. jury of the perjury case. And so he's currently here. He's a man in his 80s, an overt terrorist. And despite this, despite the heavy evidence against him and the fact that the U.S. could charge Posada, for example, with the hotel bombings in Havana that took place in 97, they have not done so. And what comes to my attention, this just a few days ago, the mayor of Hialeah in Miami-Dade County, of course in Florida, Mr. Carlos Hernandez, has decided that he's going to, quote, honor Luis Posada and give him the keys to the city. That was on June 14th during a city council meeting, just a few days ago. So listen to that again. Mayor Carlos Hernandez of Hialeah in Miami-Dade County has given an honor to the terrorist Luis Posada the keys to the city of Hialeah. Well, I don't think the people of Hialeah should sleep well on June 14th. And what's interesting about June 14th is, of course, it's Flag Day in the United States when we honor our flag. Well, I guess it's appropriate that they gave a terrorist the keys to the city on Flag Day. Once again, we're going to give you an accountability story, accountability for torture and murder committed by the CIA in the United States in the so-called War on Terror. So far, almost none of our accountability stories have come out good. Somehow, all of the CIA agents, whether it was the ones who sent Maher Arar for torture in Syria, whether it was those people at Abu Ghraib, whether it was Rumsfeld for the techniques at Guantanamo, none of the stories come out really on the good side. Yes, we're pursuing our cases in Spain. Those have some positive elements. We've taken testimony in one of the Spanish cases against Jeffrey Miller, who was the head of Guantanamo for a period of time. So some international justice is proceeding, whether in Spain or in Italy or in some of the other countries in Europe. On the other hand, we had a very bad blow a few months ago in a case concerning the, quote, suicides of three men at Guantanamo Bay. The center and others have been representing the families of those three to try and get to the bottom of their, quote, suicides. There's a lot of evidence out there that they weren't suicides at all. The U.S. at the time of the, quote, suicides, which took place roughly simultaneously, or approximately roughly the same time, called them asymmetrical warfare. What they mean by that, completely unclear, but what it means is there's a way that, you know, Al-Qaeda or Taliban, and no one has any evidence that these three people were that, are doing something that is not a direct confrontation, but is asymmetrical. And somehow that's a type of warfare that is trying to embarrass or get at the United States. So the claim at the time of the three deaths was that it was an act of asymmetrical warfare. The center didn't believe it, and there was a lot of evidence that it was not the case, that these were not simultaneous suicides. It wasn't any kind of asymmetrical warfare. But the conditions at Guantanamo being unbearable, et cetera, and it may have been that these three were actually murdered. And in the last year or so, led by really Scott Horton and Harper's Magazine, some evidence has come out from some of the soldiers who were there, as well as from others, that this was not cases of suicide, but it's possible that these people were taken to an off-site black site and murdered at that black site. The Center for Constitutional Rights and other attorneys lost the case in the district court on the usual kinds of ways you lose these cases. Either they're state secrets or you can hold U.S. officials liable for these kinds of things, and they dismissed it. The news on this front is that a few days ago, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed an appeal for the families of two of the three men who died in these mysterious circumstances in June 2006. This appeal was filed nearly 5 days to the day after the three men died at Guantanamo under what are still unexplained circumstances. And I just want to read you some of the testimony, really, of the families of these people. Here's a person who's the father of a man named Yasser, it'll explain. My son Yasser was 17 when he was taken to Guantanamo and 21 when he died there, said Talal el-Zahrani, father of Yasser. Quote, I've waited for 5 years for meaningful answers to my questions about how my son died, but the U.S. government has never contacted me. Not when my son died, not in response to my questions afterward, and not to this day. A man named Nashwan el-Salami, whose brother Salah also died at Guantanamo, said, For 5 years, the U.S. government and courts have blocked my family's efforts to know the truth about how my brother died. My father died without ever learning what happened to his son, my brother, and I continue to hope for real answers and justice. And here's a statement by Tarek Dagul, a British citizen who was wrongfully detained at Guantanamo and is now back at home in England. Here's what he said. I knew Yasser, Salah, and Manny, who's the third man, personally, for a long period of time, and I knew of their deep will to resist being broken by Guantanamo and to live. These were beautiful men, and Yasser and Manny used to sing songs and recite poetry to lift the spirits of the other detained men. They always fought for the rights of all of us to be free from the abuses we were tormented with, and they were repeatedly subjected to harsh treatment because of this. I have never believed these men committed suicide, as the government claims. As the center said in its release on this appeal, the new evidence is not the result of wild speculations of the families or their attorneys or a journalist. It comes from the eyewitness accounts of four decorated soldiers who were compelled to come forward by their consciences out of a sense of duty and at great personal and professional risk. When the only people who know the truth and are our clients' dead sons and individuals within the government, the information these four men have brought forth is critical. It is shameful that this information has not been given greater consideration by the court. So the center is appealing these what we believe may well have been murders of two of the three men. Let's hope for a better result than we've had in the past. By our appeal, we're asking the Obama Justice Department to not do what it has routinely been doing in cases that attempt accountability against the torture team. Change position, allow the court cases to go on, and get to the truth of these killings at Guantanamo.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
On many of our shows, we've discussed the broad, overreaching powers and underhanded tactics the FBI uses when targeting activists, activists of any sort, environmentalists, animal rights people, Palestinians, Muslims, anti-war people, pacifists, really almost any kind of activist at all interests the FBI. Now, unfortunately, the FBI is expanding even more. Its new internal guidelines will allow agents easier access to search commercial or law enforcement databases, conduct lie detector tests, search people's trash, and conduct physical surveillance. They will be able to do so without any evidence of criminality, simply on an agent's whim. Big Brother is with us. These guidelines will be part of a new edition of the FBI manual, the Domestic Investigations and Operations Guide. Civil libertarians and others have criticized the guidelines in light of the recent cases such as the Fort Dix 5, the Newburgh 4, and Yasin Arif case in Albany, where the FBI is accused of entrapping people by infiltrating ethnic and religious communities. This pervasive and increasing FBI surveillance is something that I and my co-author, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, and the Center for Constitutional Rights have documented in a new book called Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in the 21st Century. It will be out in a few weeks, and it not only talks about the history of dissent in this country, what's happened today at demonstrations and going forward, but it also has contained within it the center book, Know Your Rights, that tells you what to do when the FBI knocks on your door. I can tell you this, that it's better not to talk to the FBI when they knock on your door. To talk more about these new FBI guidelines, we're joined by returning guest Mike German, a former FBI agent who is now an attorney with the ACLU in Washington. Mike, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
I know your recent appearances have been primarily about the change in what is called the operational guidelines for domestic investigations. And I want to go to those. That's one change that we've seen. And we've also seen a week before we saw the passage of some provisions of the Patriot Act as well.
Right.
Maybe there's a way you can just tell our listeners what those two coming together means. Here we are some 10 years after 9/11 almost.
Well, you know, these are both, you know, additional incremental steps towards this situation that has our fundamental constitutional values on their head, where the government is saying that they have the unfettered authority to look into your private life without any justification, and they're claiming they don't need any factual basis to suspect you of wrongdoing, and yet, as Americans, we have no right to know what the government is doing with these authorities or what it's doing with the information it collects. And I think that's, you know, very problematic and harmful to our society.
Let me give people a sense of the structure, because, of course, when the Patriot Act was passed a few weeks after 9/11, there were a couple of provisions put in there that had, quote, sunset provisions. Of course, you and I as lawyers are familiar with what happens with sunset provisions, is they supposedly say that within a four-year period or whatever period they put in, this provision is out of the law because it's controversial and people say we won't need it. And then it has to be renewed. And, you know, my experience has been sunset provisions generally don't set. I think there's one in particular having to do with national security letters that didn't set. And what is that?
Right. National security letters are a tool that was created for FBI agents to investigate foreign spies during the Cold War. You know, so this was something developed to go after KGB spies here in this country. And it gradually was expanded to also include international terrorists. What the Patriot Act did is it amended it to say that you could use this tool not just against suspected spies and terrorists, but against anybody who's relevant to an investigation of spies or terrorists. So what that did was completely expand whose information could be collected, so that the fact that the government had no reason to suspect you was no longer relevant to whether they could use this tool. And what happened when it was originally set to sunset in 2005, but what happened was, since these powers are exercised under such secrecy, there was little opportunity for Congress to really know how it had been used. And Department of Justice and the FBI were adamant that there were no violations of the law. So they were reauthorized in 2006. But the Congress said, you know, we want to have a peek into what's going on with these authorities. So they asked the Inspector General to do an audit of the FBI's use of national security letters and use of Section 215 authority, which is the authority to go to the secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and get an order for anything, also based on this low relevance standard. And what the Inspector General found, they actually did five separate reports, which sort of gives you an idea of the scope of the problems that they found, but basically that the FBI was using these tools against people two and three times removed from the subjects of their investigation. So, you know, that would be not just the person that the subject called, but the person they called and the person they called and the person they called. So it got far, far out from what this tool is designed to do.
What kind of records do they get under the tool?
They can get records regarding your communications, not the content, just who you're talking to, when, and for how long. They can get records regarding your financial accounts, bank accounts, and other financial accounts, and also your credit history.
And do they have to notify you that they're getting these records?
Not only do they not have to notify you, they actually gag your bank or the phone company to prevent them from telling you.
You have some sense of the numbers of these national securities letters they get?
We had a sense from the IG audit. The IG audited between 2003 and 2006. And during that time period, there were over 200,000 NSLs, national security.
Absolutely huge amount of data, obviously.
Right.
So that was renewed a couple of weeks ago, right?
Right. So that wasn't one of the expiring provisions, but there were three other provisions that were coming up. But because national security letters had been so abused, there was some public initiative to enact some reforms. While we have to pass legislation to renew these other authorities, let's at least reform what we know is being abused. And yet, in the end, there were not even very modest changes that some bills had suggested to try to curb the abuse.
So that's still going on. And then, of course, we got hit. We woke up and saw your name, of course, in the New York Times article on the change in the domestic guidelines. It's not the official word, because there's the...
It's the Domestic Investigations and Operations Guide. And what this is the FBI's internal investigations policies that implements their investigative authorities, which are created by the Department of Justice under what's called the Attorney General Guidelines.
Right. The Attorney General Guidelines, and of course you've talked about it both on your various shows as well as in writing. Those, and I'm familiar with that because I'm probably even older than you, but from the 70s when we exposed all the FBI spying in the United States and we got a series of Attorney General's guidelines that were at least modestly restrictive, probably a high watermark in 19 whatever year they came out, 76 or right after.
And they were designed to curb the abuse, and that's really the key part of it, that when there aren't guidelines governing when and who the FBI should investigate, they tend to stray from people who we want them investigating. We want them investigating people who are engaged in wrongdoing or planning some horrible thing that might hurt somebody. But what we don't want them doing is wasting time and invading the privacy of completely innocent people. So the guidelines were put in place to make sure that the FBI had some factual basis for suspecting somebody before they started using very intrusive tools to investigate them. And as an FBI agent for 16 years, I found that was actually a very effective way of making me focus my investigations on people who are actually doing bad things rather than people who are just saying things I didn't like or otherwise I didn't, you know, think what they were doing was right, but it wasn't illegal.
So these broad, what we call the Attorney General's guidelines, have been changed and changed, and I've just seen watered down, you know, every few years. After 9/11, Ashcroft put out another set as Attorney General, and then right before Bush left office, there was another set, which are called the Mukasey guidelines. He is the Attorney General. And then Obama took office and has not done anything. Can you just has not done anything to change those. What were some of the aspects that caused concern with those attorney general's guidelines?
Right. You know, so they, as you said, under Ashcroft, after 9/11, had been amended considerably. So it was kind of surprising to see in December of 2008 that the outgoing administration had radically altered the guidelines. It specifically, you know, one of the most concerning parts was taking or creating a new investigative authority they were calling assessments, and giving the FBI to initiate these assessments. It's an amazing standard to see in print, where there is no factual predicate, which means there are absolutely no facts to give an agent any belief that anybody had done anything wrong, which, as a former agent, I found astounding and very troubling that people who were completely innocent and not even suspected of wrongdoing could come under suspicion through an investigation under these assessments, all perfectly lawful according to the Attorney General.
Right. So those are the Attorney General's guidelines. And then now what we're focusing on or moving toward is what we're going to, let's call it, the FBI internal guidelines, which were the ones that these new ones haven't been issued, but they're the ones that have caused the storm. Why don't you describe, you were actually in a meeting where you got to at least, I guess, review them or look at them. Why don't you tell us about what happened?
So when the 2008 guidelines came out, the FBI created this document, this manual that was the implementation of those guidelines. And we were very concerned about that 2008 version because it allowed, among other things, you know, obviously it allowed these assessments to take place, but specifically that they allowed the FBI to start collecting racial and ethnic demographic information and mapping communities based on race and ethnicity, and also tracking racial and ethnic behavior and facilities. So we're trying to get information through the Freedom of Information Act on that. But then we got this call that, you know, they wanted to talk to us about some amendments that they were making, and I was somewhat hopeful that they had listened to our criticism and were going to narrow them somewhat. But what we found was they had actually only taken the perspective of the FBI agents into account. And not surprisingly, the FBI agents wanted more autonomy and less oversight. So virtually all of the amendments that they suggested they were going to implement were actually giving the FBI more power.
Let's walk you through an example. Let's say I get together with some friends and I want to do a completely lawful demonstration against killing dogs when they're picked up on the streets, or, I mean, almost any subject. For the FBI to open an investigation of me, I guess there's what they call an assessment, or now there's a pre-assessment. Right. What does an agent have to do, and what can he do without really having any evidence that I might commit a crime?
Well, even without opening an assessment, just on his own whim, according to these new changes, he would be able to search for information in private databases, these commercial databases that data aggregators, you know, pull together all sorts of different information about people that they sell to, you know, marketers and also to the government, and also state and local law enforcement information. So you can imagine this is, you know, not just if you've actually been charged with a crime, but if you've been a victim of a crime or a witness to a criminal act or somehow otherwise were collected in state and local law enforcement information, and the FBI can, you know, FBI agent can just peruse through this data even without actually officially opening an investigation. And then all it requires to open an assessment, in the Attorney General guidelines, it doesn't even require supervisory approval to open an assessment. But the FBI's internal policy does have some level, but again, there's no factual predicate required. So, you know, there's no necessity to identify what federal crime they think you're violating or what information they have to believe that you're violating some crime. So it's a very extremely low standard, and there's no time period on it. And the tools that they can use are really very intrusive. They can do physical surveillance. They can
stand outside my house and look at it.
They can stand outside your house, follow you around 24/7. They can recruit an informant to go up and start engaging you in a, you know, false pretense to try to gather information from you or from your neighbors. They can interview your neighbors. They can interview your employer you know, which all has a real chilling effect because, you know, when the FBI comes knocking on people's doors, they assume the FBI has some facts that it's working from that suggests you're doing something wrong.
But and this is without any evidence of a crime, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
In other words, if I just get together with people and say, let's do a demonstration against the war in Afghanistan or whatever subject we want to make up, an FBI agent hears me on the radio say, Michael Ratner, come to this demonstration, they can start doing all of what you've just said, from the databases to the physical surveillance, recruiting an informant, which is, I think, among the most serious things you've said, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we don't have to come up with this hypothetical. The Inspector General of the Department of Justice did an investigation of the FBI's investigating domestic advocacy groups. And what he found was based on very weak factual predicates and often what he called speculative information. So it would be the agent sitting in his office saying, well, I speculate that this Michael Ratner, who is starting this group, might someday commit a crime in the future. So that is the only justification I need to start an investigation. And these investigations, the Inspector General found, often lasted for years. And one key element he brought out was when you became subject of an investigation, you actually went on the terrorist watch list. So it had a real implication for these people, these activists who were being surveilled and investigated, often, you know, in very detail for a long time. It, of course, does nothing to protect security because they were all determined to be completely innocent of any wrongdoing and you know, obviously invaded their privacy. So the scary thing that the Inspector General revealed was these investigations he looked at were all under the 2002 guidelines. And he said where he found violations, they would not be violations under the 2008 guidelines. That all would be perfectly legitimate.
I recall that, and I recall that being really interesting because especially the being looking at these as either terrorist investigations or saying these people are on a terrorist list. And right. It was always when, I remember when the early acts came out after 9/11, it was one of our concerns that they would label lawful dissent, essentially, or even civil disobedience as terrorist investigations. And when the Attorney General, as I recall, or fine, the Inspector General, essentially said he shouldn't have done it, but it was lawful to do it. At least it would be under the new guidelines.
Right, exactly. Where he criticized the FBI was in leaving the investigations open too long, but he said, you know, the guideline standard was so low that even just the mere speculation that somebody might commit a crime in the future was all the justification needed to open a case.
Now, those were, you know, various advocacy groups, protest groups, and they looked at about a half a dozen of them, I don't remember.
Right.
But I think, as you said in a recent interview, that those are conceivably only the tip of the iceberg. How extensive do you think it is?
Absolutely. We think it's widespread based on the fact that in 2004, 2005, 2006, the ACLU, on behalf of a number of advocacy groups who felt that they were under some kind of investigation, it initiated a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests across the country. And, you know, in many of these cases with these, you know, long-standing advocacy groups that had not been involved in any criminal activity, we did find that they were being surveilled. And when the Inspector General did his investigation, he only looked at the cases and only some of the cases that we had already revealed. He didn't look for anything beyond what, you know, sort of in a guesswork that the ACLU had already revealed. So we think that if you look beyond that, that you would find much more. And particularly if you look at that report and hear the defensiveness that the agents were expressing about how what they were doing was legitimate, even though, you know, he documented that there were, you know, years of investigation that revealed no wrongdoing whatsoever. You know, the agents still felt that it was appropriate to do what they were doing. So we suspect that it's going on at a much greater extent. And we're seeing it not just at the FBI, but in state and local law enforcement on our Spy Files website, www.aclu.org/spyfiles. We've documented spying on or obstruction of First Amendment protected activity in 31 states and the District of Columbia.
Oh,
so this is a widespread problem And, you know, it sort of, unfortunately, was entirely predictable because, of course, these rules were put in place to prevent exactly that, because that's what the FBI and the state and local police were doing in the absence of rules. So it's not surprising that when you take those rules away, they once again go into that political spying mode.
Let me go just another question into informants, because you mentioned that even without any criminal activity, they could conceivably recruit an informant and put it into a First Amendment protected organization that's doing protest or political activity or whatever. How do they do that, and how dangerous do you consider that?
I consider it very dangerous. You know, that is really one of the more intrusive tools that the FBI has. Many times, informants are working with dubious motives, either to get themselves out of trouble or, you know, to receive some kind of monetary payment. So, you know, it's an area that the FBI has often gotten in trouble with in the past, so it has to be very carefully regulated and used only when the FBI has a significant amount of evidence that somebody's doing something wrong, because they can often, you know, take a leadership role, either overtly by claiming some leadership role in the organization, or even by not claiming any leadership role, but just by their, you know, influence over others, encourage people to engage in acts they may not have engaged in on their own volition. And it creates concern in the community about what the government's motives are, whether they're no longer investigating crime, but actually initiating crime.
And we've seen that, of course, and we've talked to you about it, some of the recent prosecutions of Muslims in particular, but in this country.
Right.
I just want to get a sense, you know, from 76 on, we've seen basically, as I said, a disintegration of really protections from the FBI and government surveillance. And now, even though it's almost 10 years after 9/11, we're seeing it not get better, but get worse.
Right.
How do you see your work, and where do we go from here? I mean, it's incredible to me, coming out of the 70s and then out of, you know, the huge investigation against Central America people, which we exposed in the 80s, and to see it even under Obama go so far downhill. I can't imagine what your work is like, but just what are you doing now to figure this out?
It's very frustrating, because so much of what's happening is happening in secret. And you know, I thought it was really quite poignant when Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, during the Patriot Act debate, the reauthorization debate just a couple weeks ago, came to the Senate floor, and he has the advantage of sitting on the Senate Intelligence Committee, so he gets to see at least as much as any congressman gets to see as to what the FBI is doing. And he came to the floor and you know, warned his colleagues, and he said, you know, the government has a secret interpretation of this law, and, you know, many of you probably don't understand how the government is interpreting the law and the types of activities that they're engaged in and collection activities that they're engaged in. And when the American public finds out, they're going to be very shocked and angry. So it just gives me more motivation to continue pushing against this increasing surveillance state and the secrecy that enables it.
I know you're doing it on a policy level and advocacy level. What do you tell people who are activists and individuals what they can do? Let's say I'm in a group. What should we do? I mean, what should we do when... Well, what should we think about? Is our group informed upon? What should we do to protect ourselves? What should we do if we get a visit from the FBI?
You know, we obviously have a Know Your Rights information that we have on our website, and I encourage people to look at that for, you know, if they are actually approached by the FBI. And, you know, you have to keep in mind, too, that the government has taken on this, what they call the Al Capone theory, where if they suspect you're a terrorist but don't have any evidence, it used to be that was pretty good evidence you weren't a terrorist. But now they're saying, well, even if we can't prove that they're a terrorist, if we think they are, we'll find some other thing that we can prosecute them for. And there was just a front page story in the Sunday New York Times, I think a week ago, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before, about a Greenpeace activist named Scott Crow. And he used the Freedom of Information Act to uncover, he was actually one of the people that would, we think, that was discussed in the IG report that covered some of the Greenpeace activists, but he went ahead and used the Freedom of Information Act to get more documents, and the FBI had actually gone to the IRS trying to get the IRS to do an audit of him to try to find, you know, some small tax violation that they could put him in jail for because they suspected him of something, yet they had years of investigation and found no wrongdoing. So, you know, it is a very dangerous environment, and I think what we have to do is make sure we're using all the tools available to us, the Freedom of Information Act, our advocacy tools, and also making sure that we have good legal advice when we do have interactions with the government.
We're speaking with Mike German, National Security Policy Counsel for ACLU. And the question is, how did you get from the FBI to the ACLU?
Well, I had been working counterterrorism in the FBI, specifically domestic terrorism, for about a dozen years, and actually having the experience of actually going undercover into violent groups, using the criminal justice tools, you know, that again use this reasonable suspicion standard very effectively to work proactively to prevent terrorist acts before they happened, and found those tools to be very effective. So after 9/11, when those tools were abandoned for these broader surveillance tools, you know, I just realized this was not going to be very effective and was actually going to be violative of people's civil liberties and privacy rights. It sort of came to a head over one case that the FBI had mishandled that I complained about. And once complaining about it and becoming a whistleblower, my career there was not long after that. And I tried internally within the FBI to change their policies for about 2 years, but finally realized that I would be more effective doing that on the outside. So I resigned and wrote a book on how terrorism really works.
What's the name of the book, Mike, so we can tell our listeners?
It's called Thinking Like a Terrorist, and it just talks about terrorism sort of from my perspective, working inside these groups, what they're actually trying to accomplish in Austin. What they're trying to accomplish is to coerce the government into taking measures that actually undermine the government's legitimacy. And I think that's, unfortunately, exactly what our government has done.
Mike German from the ACLU, thank you very much for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Anytime.
Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.